Good morning, good afternoon, good whatever day you have right now. This is Shirley Gutkowski, and this is Crosslink Radio, and today is the big day, the World Day of Orofacial Myofunctional Science, and our two-hour special looking at the science of orofacial myofunctional therapy. We have a very busy day ahead looking at all of the different aspects of the mouth and how it affects health, not just with periodontal disease. And it may be that periodontal disease and dental decay are just signs that your airway is under attack or your airway is not working appropriately. So that's what we're going to do today and explore this incredibly huge science of orofacial myofunctional therapy. My name is Shirley Gutkowski. I'm the host of Crosslink Radio, and this is still the only podcast looking at health from the eye teeth on down. There are other podcasts that kind of center on dental hygienists or dentists are having podcasts to try to drive patients to their practice. And I have, since 2013, been providing a huge array of different kinds of projects and science and elements to create health that include the health of the mouth. And nothing happens when your mouth is sick, and we just don't honor that, I don't think, well enough. Today's special will include a lot of information, as you can imagine. We are going to be starting with Joy Moeller, who is the one of the biggest names right now in orofacial myofunctional therapy. She is my mentor and instructor, and she was the mentor and instructor for my other mentor, Beth Thompson, who is the owner of Career Fusion. Beth had opened her own orofacial myofunctional practice, and she had seen a lot of really awesome results, and I was just slow to pick it up. So I took Joy Moeller's classes, and I was instantly motivated and hyperactivated. I allowed some things to get in my way, and they are no longer there. So that's going to be our first guest, and she's going to be talking with us about some of the new science that's showing orofacial myofunctional therapy impacting many different areas of health, especially airway. Allison Hazelbaker of the Hazelbaker Lactation Institute will chime in about detecting lingual frenum attachment problems at birth and what to do about that. Diane Barr is of Ages and Stages. She's our feeding expert and will talk with us about different ways of managing the child's tongue and mouth with food and food choices that will help them develop good habits and good airway in their childhood. Leisha Pasquet is the president of the Academy of Advanced Myofunctional Science, and she'll be talking with us as well. Dr. Denise DeWald is a pediatrician in Chicago, and she'll be talking with us about how her practice has changed now that she is also trained in orofacial myofunctional therapy. Then we have three different hygienists who have developed a specialty in orofacial myofunctional therapy, practicing in New York and Nebraska and Montana. Dr. Gelb and Dr. Hinden are two airway dentists who have developed the American Academy of Physiological Medicine and Dentistry and the foundation that helps support multidisciplinary activities to make sure that people are getting the full scope of help that they need to develop a decent airway. And then we're going to wrap it up today with Mark Moeller, who is the Executive Director of the Academy of Orofacial Myofunctional Therapy and Acting Executive Director of the Academy of Advanced Myofunctional Science, which is a worldwide organization that brings together and disseminates information about orofacial myofunctional therapy, the practice of OMT, worldwide, particularly in Brazil, where everything seems to have taken steroids. So without further complications and without further drama, let's get started with our interview with Joy after this tiny commercial break.
This program is sponsored by Primal Air, Orofacial Myofunctional Therapy and Breathing Retraining. Located in the heart of Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, Primal Air is dedicated to integrating oral and systemic health. By learning specialized techniques, you can achieve the full genetic potential of your personal airway. Tongue-tied? Hate your CPAP? Don't want to look tired? Call or email to schedule an in-person or virtual appointment. 608-213-5865 or primalairomt@gmail.com.
Hi. How are you today?
I'm great. So let's talk a little bit about the science, as this is World Day of Orofacial Myofunctional Science, and go over some of the key papers that have come out recently supporting orofacial myofunctional therapy with respect to all kinds of health problems.
Okay, well, I've been in the field a long time, and the science behind myofunctional therapy has completely come out of the closet the last, I'd say 10 or 15 years especially. I know in Brazil, they've had, for many years, they've had PhD programs in myofunctional therapy, and they kind of led the way to pique the interest of researchers all over the world. I know in 2009, Kathia Gromara's study came out. It was published in the American Journal of Respiratory Critical Care Medicine, which is the blue journal. And this started like a whole new look at myofunctional therapy. The title of her article was The Effects of Oral Pharyngeal Exercises on Patients with Moderate Obstructive Sleep Apnea. And she proved that in a three-month period, 39% reduction of AHI numbers, which was huge, huge. It kind of hit the world of sleep right between the eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And researchers from all over were looking at that, saying, what is this?
How did that happen?
And luckily for us, Christian Dino, who he was a physician at Stanford for many years in the field of sleep, he's the person who first coined the term AHI, which is apneic hypopneic index, the times that you stop breathing. He started many years earlier than this, knowing that he called it re-education of the muscles. He knew that was important because he was from France and they had been doing that for many years there. So after this article came out, he decided to jump in and do a lot more studies on myofunctional therapy. And he has come up with some groundbreaking studies that go into everything from prevention with infants, mm-hmm. pediatric, to looking at lingual freedom restriction and relating that to sleep disorders. And he's made a huge impact, especially with children. Also, at the same time in Brazil, there were a few researchers that were working on what happens in oral facial pain patients. Claudia Maria de Felicio and Marco Antonio Moreira Rodriguez from Da Silva from Brazil started looking at the effects of orofacial myofunctional therapy on temporomandibular joint disorders.
Mm.
They've written several really amazing articles. The beautiful thing about the Brazilian is that they actually give you the exercises right in the articles.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and look, their latest study was on chewing and how you have to when you have oral facial pain patients, you have to chew on both sides, which is phenomenal. And at the same time, there were some people writing articles for orthodontic journals, and Joanne Smith-Peter in Portland teamed up with a Dr. Covell, who wrote an article on relapse of anterior open bite with or without myofunctional therapy, and proved that myofunctional therapy was important for this. And then also Dr. Camacho did this, he headed up this meta-analysis study, which was huge, huge, huge. That this just came out last year, as a matter of fact, and it was done at 4 universities up in the world, different universities, Stanford, UCLA, in Argentina, and Portugal. So, and they all came up with the conclusion, the meta-analysis looked at every research paper out there and concluded that, or demonstrated that myofunctional therapy decreases the apneic hypopneic index by approximately 50% in adults and 62% in children.
Those are kind of crazy numbers. I mean, 50% is pretty substantial. So it's nice to have some proof to that behind it. I'm glad they did that meta-analysis there.
And another very important study, in my eyes, is Christian Guimeneau again looked at breathing, and his article, Towards Restoration of Continuous Nasal Breathing as the Ultimate Treatment Goal in Pediatric Obstructive Sleep Apnea. And that was huge, because he said that you really had to eliminate oral breathing, maybe, and that restoration of nasal breathing during wake and sleep may be the only valid endpoint in treating obstructive sleep apnea. And he also went on to say preventive measures in at-risk groups, such as premature infants, and the use of myofunctional therapy as part of the treatment of OSA are proposed to be important approaches to treat all of sleep disorder breathing and its multiple comorbidities. That's huge. That statement is huge as far as I'm concerned, because you know that we need to get people breathing through their nose if we want to survive as a species.
We also know there are a few studies that correlate sleep apnea in children with hyperactivity, and if we can go with the sciences that show that OMT reduces sleep apnea and the hypopneic index in children of 62%, that we might be able to decrease this hyperactivity thing that we've got going in the United States. It's crazy.
Oh yeah, the drugs now that they use on children, horrible, and they zombieize children. I call them my zombie patients that come in, but they still are nervous and anxious, even with the medication, and their learning, their ability to learn is hampered, even with the medication. So I feel that we need to get to the cause of this issue. Also, Maria Pia Vila, who's from Sapienza University in Rome, she's an amazing woman. She's a pediatric sleep specialist, a pediatrician, and she started writing for many years. She's known that myofunctional therapy helps, and she started practicing with a physical therapist who is a myofunctional therapist. And what she did was she took a group of children with large tonsils and adenoids, They did a polysomnography, which is the in office sleep study, the highest gold standard. And they took a group of these children with big tonsils. They did a sleep study first. Then they took out the tonsils, and then they waited and adenoids. These are children between the ages of 3 to 5. And they took the tonsils out. They waited a year. They did another polysomnography and found that a large percentage, I think it was over 70% of the children still had sleep disorders, sleep apnea. Mm-hmm. Then they put those patients on myofunctional exercises and then did another sleep study a year later and found that none of the children had sleep apnea after that. So that was a really powerful study. And so she concluded that myofunctional therapy was an oral pharyngeal exercises may be considered complementary therapy to tonsillectomy, adenoidectomy, to effectively treat pediatric obstructive sleep apnea. Now, the problem that we've had has been the motivation, and that to keep children doing it for the control period of time. So whoever treats children that age group has to really like working with children and keep them motivated. And of course, the mothers need to be the therapists at home. So right. They have to understand the importance of it and support the therapy at home, which is difficult in our society because mothers are going back to work when the children are 2 weeks old.
Yeah, right.
But yeah. We can caregivers too. So
it's a crazy system we have here. Thank you so much, Joy, for sharing some of the big studies that link orofacial myofunctional therapy with sleep apnea and behavior and some other things. It's a big topic, and I think we should all just be aware and continue to look for more studies and to do more studies on orofacial myofunctional therapy.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you so much for everything you do.
Thank you, Joy. So, Dr. Hazelbaker has been a therapist for over 30 years and specializes in cross-disciplinary treatment, and to that end has taken training in several modalities to best assist her clients. She is trained in craniosacral therapy, lymph drainage therapy, and she is a board-certified lactation consultant, and we're going to be talking to her about tongue tie and evaluating a tongue tie in an infant. Good day, Dr. Hazelbaker.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate your time. I know that you're super-duper busy. So let's get right to it. What is a tongue tie, and how do we know that a baby has a tongue tie?
So a tongue tie is a remnant, an embryological remnant of connective tissue that connects the underside of the tongue to the floor of the mouth that restricts normal tongue mobility. It is a congenital anomaly as opposed to an acquired issue, and is in the most obvious cases very visible, but in less obvious cases requires a real thorough assessment to determine the presence or absence of a prominent lingual frenulum. So assessment requires looking at function, because we're looking at tongue mobility as opposed to just what the frenulum looks like. The frenulum looks a lot of different ways. Mm-hmm. It's as individual as a fingerprint. So because of this wide variation in appearance, it's really important for us to look at tongue function as opposed to just looking at the lingual frenulum per se. And in that way, we're able to make a differential diagnosis, differentiating a sucking problem or tongue mobility problem problem that's due to tongue tie versus any number of other things that can impair tongue function, you know, as a result of other structural problems or neurological issues or whatever. So there's a wide range of causes of impaired tongue mobility, tongue tie only being one of them. Proper assessment proceeds utilizing a methodologically sound tool. It's not enough just to lift up the tongue and go, oh, hey, look what we've got here. Mm-hmm. We need to go in and assess functions. The assessment tool for lingual frenulum function, a tool that I authored 25 years ago, is currently the only evidence-based tool for assessing tongue tie in infants under 6 months of age in the world. There is another one that is under development in Brazil, that is the Martinelli-Markeson tool, okay, Frenum inspection tool, and that is undergoing validation at this point. It hasn't undergone reliability studies yet, so they're in the process. It takes several years, sure, to develop a really good, strong tool that holds over time. So I'm looking forward to seeing Martinelli and Markeson continue their work.
Okay, so that's like a paper test, right? You go through the steps and you look for this and for that and for this and for that. It's not like a hammer or a tool where you stick it in the baby's mouth and then they have to do tricks around that tool.
Right, right. It is a paper tool, and it describes what it is that you're looking for, and you have to be trained to utilize these tools, and you go in and you do actual functional assessments on babies so that you can see if there are any deficits or if they're within the range of normal.
I think the training is really important, that we just spend 1 second on that with the tool, because you don't know what you're looking at until you're shown what you're looking at, which is really loud in my head right now as I'm really exploring this myofunctional therapy, and now nobody looks right. I can't watch some TV shows because people aren't using their mouth right. And so, being trained with this tool allows you to be able to see things that you wouldn't normally see if you were uninitiated, I guess.
Yes, that's very true. That's very true. And any time that you're assessing function, you really need to undergo the process of having somebody guide you to teach you what it is that you want to look for. Nobody masters this stuff, in the first mm-hmm. go-around.
Right.
So it takes practice. Once you've been initiated, it takes practice as well.
So who is that usually? So that would be a lactation specialist like you are, or is this the dentist, or is this the nurse practitioner? Who's in charge of that?
Well, anybody who's a first responder with infants or who's in a position to work with a breastfeeding mother and baby, or even a bottle feeding mother and baby, because the mm-hmm. ATLIF is for screening all babies. It isn't just for breastfed babies. So, anybody can learn how to use the assessment tool. It isn't just for lactation consultants. But not everybody has the expertise or the background in sucking physiology to be able to know, to understand the parameters that we're looking at. So we don't necessarily want somebody who doesn't have a background to go assessing for tongue tie.
Right.
We want them to have the background first. So people who know the mouth, people who know about tongue function, lactation consultants, nurse practitioners who work with feeding issues, OTs, speech language pathologists, et cetera, that work with feeding issues, those would all be people who probably are the most qualified to assess for tongue tie.
And so not the ladies on the tongue tie group on Facebook.
Not the parents on the Facebook group, for tongue tie. No, they don't have the skill to be able to look at a picture, which is a one moment in time kind of thing.
Yep.
To be able to pronounce whether or not somebody else's baby has a tongue tie. No, not that.
Well, that's good to know. And it is good to know, because I have been following them a little bit, and I don't know that I've seen any shaming or badgering to do it one way or the other, or maybe I'm just not looking close enough. But they are encouraging to one another to do things, and
It needs to be evaluated, as we talked about, by somebody who knows what it is they're looking at. And that's not easy to find. That's not everybody.
Right.
What about these APGAR scores that they do on the infants right after birth? I think that's the acronym. Does that include a tongue tie evaluation?
No. The APGAR score is for looking at fetal well-being. And APGAR scores are predictive of neurological problems. So it's important that we continue to do the APGAR score. But that is looking at five different parameters, including infant color, whether or not they're breathing, what their tone looks like, et cetera. So that's what that's looking for. And it's done at 1 minute and at 5 minutes. Tongue tie screening is done after the initial adjustment period that the baby makes in the early postpartum time, where they've had a chance to go to breast, they've had a chance to do in that first hour the breast crawl, and they're satisfied their sensitive period for bonding, satisfy the sensitive period for milk production, and just get a time to hang out with their mom and their dad so that they can start to coalesce as a family. Mm-hmm. So we wait to do this kind of screening until later on in the first day or into the second day to give that baby plenty of time to adjust. And then we go in and we do that screening while we're looking at other things. Mm-hmm. And it's an easy thing to do once you learn the functional parameters that you're looking for, and you can get it done in 30 seconds while you're checking out the baby suck in general. So it is something that we want to do early. Uh-huh. It is something that we want to do early so that we can prevent problems, get the baby, if it is tongue-tied, shuttled off to the right practitioner as quickly as possible so that we can get the tongue tie clipped so that the baby doesn't develop compensation. So early is great. Not too early, however. Okay. We really want that family to have time to bond.
So I've heard ENTs doing this surgery. I've heard dentists doing this surgery. My pediatrician, my OBGYN did some male surgery on my children. We'll just leave it at that. Who's in charge of doing the phrenectomy at the hospital level and then outside?
Well, currently we have different practitioners. We have ear, nose, throat docs, we have general practitioners, we have pediatricians. All three of those categories of physicians, neonatologists sometimes also, when they're knowledgeable, are getting on board to take care of this and take care of it as soon as possible in the hospital before the baby and the mom leave. Out in the community, we will see other primary care practitioners, nurse practitioners, midwives, dentists. All of these people here in the United States are allowed to do minor surgery. In other countries, lactation consultants do the surgery. So IBCLCs in England are allowed to do phrenotomy, and IBCLCs in Australia are allowed to do phrenotomy.
Wow.
And they have training programs for them. So, it depends on the country and how their health service is set up and all of those things. Where you have fewer physicians, as you do in a national health service, they utilize their nurses, their midwives, et cetera, more so than we do here to deliver these services.
Excellent. So we are at our time. Is there anything that you wanted to say for sure and you want to maybe get that in? And where can people find you?
So the last thing I want to say is we really have to work together in order to create continuity of care and increase access to services. And we also need to work together to do more research so that we can answer some of the unanswered questions that surround the issue of tongue tie. And people can find me at www.allison with one L. Hazelbaker, atlif.com. And if anybody's interested in downloading the Atlif, that is free. They can do so at that website. And if anybody is interested in getting trained to use the Atlif, we have just posted the next workshop that we're doing in Columbus, Ohio, and people can sign up for that workshop via the website.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Dr. Hazel Baker. I really appreciate your time and your expertise, and keep on fighting on.
Well, thank you, Shirley, for having me. It's been lovely.
You're very welcome. Our next guest is Diane Barr. She is a certified speech-language pathologist and infant massage instructor. She has practiced speech-language pathology since 1980 and has been a feeding therapist since 1983. Her experiences include teaching graduate, undergraduate, and continuing education courses, working with children and adults who exhibit a variety of speech, language, feeding, and swallowing disorders, and publishing, presenting information on oral sensory motor function assessment and treatment. She is the author of a textbook called Oral Motor Assessment and Treatment, Ages and Stages. She has also written a book for parents and professionals entitled Nobody Ever Told Me or My Mother That. Everything from bottles and breathing to healthy speech development, which is available on Amazon and on her website, agesandstages.net. So, hi there, Diane.
Hi.
Let's talk a little bit about children's becoming sensitized motor development-wise, not like allergy-wise, to different foods and how they kind of grow into eating different foods.
Okay, so you introduce foods around 6 months of age. Those are our current guidelines of the World Health Organization and the American Academy of Pediatrics. I just looked at that last week to check it.
Make sure it's
because
still
true. Because it does change. It changes. And so when you introduce foods to children, you want to introduce them one at a time. Especially if you think it might be a sensitizing food. So in my book, I have a chart that has the most allergenic foods and then sensitizing foods, ones that people tend to be sensitive to, but they're not the most allergenic. And then I have the least allergenic foods. It's in three columns in my book. And what you can do is start to introduce foods that are less allergenic, and there are many, many of them, and rice, of course, is one of them, and of course, milk, you're not going to introduce till later, around 12 months of age, because that's one of the most allergenic foods. And then when you introduce a food, you want to introduce it, like one new food every 4 days, because that's about how long it takes food to get through the digestive system completely. So that way you make sure there's no rashes or sneezing or any kind of allergic symptoms that are going along with the food introduction.
So the children are playing, they're tasting everything. They're trying to, what do their feet taste like and what do mommy's keys taste like and all of that other kind of stuff. And then how does that relate to foods and food choices and how does that all kind of work together?
We talked in our other interview, I guess I can refer to that here, our longer one, about discriminative mouthing, which is happening about 5 months of age, it starts where the baby is taking their own fingers throughout the mouth. They're trying to put everything in the mouth, like mom's keys. We introduce appropriate mouth toys, which I talked about. I love the Beckman Tri-Chews. Mary Schiavone Chewy Tubes has a whole line of safe mouth toys. And so as these children are doing this discriminative mouthing, they are, they're feeling and exploring food throughout the mouth, all the way from the front to the back. They've worked their gags back by 6 months. The gag is only located on the back one-third of the tongue, or should be. Newborn babies have a gag that's fairly forward. It's kind of the back three-quarters of the tongue. But it's through these mouthing experiences they work this gag back. And then by 6 months, they're ready to try foods that you mash up and are soft, like soft baby cookies, different textures, learn to, you know, we talked about different utensils. They can learn to drink from take sips from an open cup held by an adult. They can have different foods as long as you're introducing them one at a time. So that's how it fits together. They prepare their mouths through good mouthing experiences, not pacifier use. That's used for calming only.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're ready for foods at 6 months because their mouths have matured motorically, and hopefully their structure has stayed in shape.
Well, and that's part of the whole thing, is that they need to learn how to chew, and that comes by exploring different foods, and the chewing is important to manipulate the muscles of the face and mouth to stimulate proper language and proper airway and proper management of their airway. And I don't know that everybody is really working that angle very well.
No, and I start parents doing jaw work and mouth massage from birth with their babies. I teach them an oral massage to get some good tongue cupping, especially babies who are bottle fed. A lot of times they're not getting the same they aren't getting the same movements as breastfed babies. So I have parents playing in their baby's mouths and getting tongue cupping. I teach them a certain jaw exercise to do so that they're chewing at the back molar area from birth. And hopefully as soon as they get those toys introduced, 3 to 4 months of age, they're moving those all around so that when they get foods to chew, and pieces, we see what we call diagonal rotary jaw movement coming in as early as 5 months of age. And so they are really ready to chew. You have to still be careful at six months. You don't want to give a six-month-old an unsafe food, and that's why in our other interview we talked about the progression, and in my book there's a progression based on development and a longitudinal study. But we can give a variety of textures beginning at 6 months.
Now, one of the things that we learned about in oral facial myofunctional therapy training is that picky eaters can be a symptom of a tongue tie or an improper airway and that kind of stuff. Or can you kind of comment on that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I think picky eating comes from a variety of places. One place that it comes from is children not getting the experience with foods.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, parents just go down the baby food aisle and they use the pouch foods and they use the pureed foods and all of that. They're not getting all the different textures, and so they're not used to it. They're not developing the habit system. But also, if you have any kind of tethered oral tissue, it can affect the tongue, it can affect the lips, it can affect the lips and cheeks, depending on where the restriction is. And certainly that will keep your tongue from placing and collecting food. Within that first year, the tongue is already moving. Well, in fact, we're born with a reflex where the tongue lateralizes to the stimulation. It's called the transverse tongue response. And through that first year, we're starting to move our tongue laterally or sideways to place and collect food. And if you have a tongue tie, you can't do that. You have to do it some other way. So tongue tie is really problematic for feeding. And so I've been lucky. I've worked with lactation consultants who have those tongue ties released near birth. And so, you know, when the babies come to me, they're already released. Mm-hmm. But not everybody has that. And, you know, I'm realizing.
Right.
And so tongue tie... And it can affect speech. People, we have a lot of research in speech pathology from the 70s that says it doesn't really affect speech that much. But speech is a very forgiving system. So somebody can learn to produce speech sounds with a tongue tie, but they can't place and collect food properly with a tongue tie.
And if the tongue doesn't get to the palate, you know, all the progress that you made with breastfeeding can stop progressing if the tongue can't get up to the palate.
Well, that's the thing. The mouth at rest from birth needs to be closed. That's why we don't want a pacifier in there all the time. We need the mouth closed at rest, and the tongue helps to maintain the palate shape, because the tongue rests against the palate, and it should always rest against the palate throughout life, you know, when the mouth is closed.
Excellent. So, Diane, people can find out more on your website, agesandstages.net, all spelled out. And right. Is there anything else that they can, any other resources you'd like to point to?
Sure. I have a book called Nobody Ever Told Me or My Mother That, Everything from Bottles and Breathing to Healthy Speech Development. I have free guides that go with that book on my site. I don't sell my book, but you'll find all the places that do sell the book on the site and read all about the book there. I have an e-course, Everything You Need to Know About a Baby's Mouth for Good Feeding, Speech, and Mouth Development. We have free blogs, Q&As from all kinds of people who do this work. So if you have a question about a topic, you can ask me, or you might already find it answered already on the site. I teach a 15-hour course that's online called Integrated Treatment of Feeding, Speech, and Mouth Function in Pediatrics. And I'm just creating a 6-hour course about what we've been talking about, prevention of feeding, speech, and mouth development problems. And there's a free course actually on my site. You can't get credit for it, but it's one I did for Dr. Dave Singh, who is the originator of the day-night appliance.
Yeah.
And so he has allowed me to put the webinar I did for him on my site.
Awesome. You're just a fountain of resources. Thank you so much, Diane, for joining us today on this special edition of CrossLink Radio. This is Shirley Gutkowski.
This program is sponsored by Primal Air, orofacial myofunctional therapy and breathing retraining. Located in the heart of Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, Primal Air is dedicated to integrating oral and systemic health. By learning specialized techniques, you can achieve the full genetic potential of your personal airway. Tongue-tied? Hate your CPAP? Don't want to look tired? Call or email to schedule an in-person or virtual appointment. 608-213-5865 or primalairomt@gmail.com.
Alicia Pasquet is the president of the Academy of Applied Myofunctional Sciences, which is a nonprofit organization, and is an advisory board member of and instructor for the Academy of Orofacial Myofunctional Therapy, a Los Angeles, California-based educational company. She works in private practice treating patients with orofacial myofunctional disorders. She's active in educating professionals and the general population on prevention and management of many health-related issues. For the last 19 years, she's been working at OPICA Adult Daycare Center in Los Angeles, working with adults who have cognitive impairment, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, vascular dementia, and strokes. For the last 14 years, she's been working at the Marilyn Hilton Multiple Sclerosis Achievement Center at UCLA, facilitating cognitive stimulation in groups of people with multiple sclerosis. Welcome, Alicia. Thank you for joining us on the World Day of OM Science on podcasts on CrossLink Radio.
Thank you so much, Shirley, for this invitation. I'm very happy to be here.
Great. Can you kind of give us a definition of what orofacial myofunctional disorders are?
Yes. As the name implies, orofacial means limited to the mouth and face, although it's kind of, you know, going outside these two borders recently. And myofunctional means the functions of the muscles. So it's a science that studies the functions and dysfunctions of the muscles of the face and mouth. And the science sometimes is called orofacial myology, and the application is called myofunctional therapy. And myofunctional therapy is the term that is most used worldwide.
Myofunctional therapy is that the term?
Yes.
Wish it was shorter.
Right, but my beef currently is that it doesn't really include the nose or the nasal function, which turns out to be fundamental for the creation of myofunctional disorders in the mouth. So in other words, if the nose doesn't work properly, then the mouth responds accordingly and tries to compensate. But orofacial myofunctional disorders ensue. So I would like to see the nose included. Mm.
That we're going to work on that. We're going to get a nice short little answer for that, I hope.
Yeah, not that easy.
So, but that kind of brings us into this multidisciplinary kind of thing that we've got resting here on orofacial myofunctional therapy. Because right away when you're talking about the nose, we already have nose specialists. They're called, you know,
ENTs.
Specialists. So right. Those would be incorporated into this OMT kind of a situation. Who else right. would be included? I mean, I think there's plenty.
Well, ideally, we would have an allergist because it turns out that the majority of nasal issues have an origin in allergies. So we have to include an allergist. Clearly, ENT would be a great member of the team because sometimes there are some structural conditions in the nose that prevent the person from breathing properly. Then, of course, we need an orthodontist because in some cases, just expanding the palate would be helpful to help the patient breathing better. Of course, we need dental hygienists because not only they can detect some problems very early in patients like gum disease or changes in the oral flora, but they are the queens, usually female, queens of motivation, so they can actually help the patient promote good behaviors that in the long run they can promote proper oral facial functions. We might also want to work with cranial osteopathic physicians because sometimes the bones of the head might not be in the proper position, and so some patients might actually need to see a cranial osteopathic physician. We might need to have patients be referred to maybe a posturologist or a chiropractor if they have other problems that affect the functions of the mouth, especially the TMJ and the jaw, but their origin is far distant, like maybe they can have flat feet or or they could have a bad back or whatever reason. So that could be helpful. We want to get involved with a speech pathologist because they know a lot about swallowing and how to correct swallowing from an atypical to a typical one. We might want to involve sleep disorder specialists, being those regular MDs or being those dentists who specialize in sleep disorders. And these are just some of the specialists that can be involved in a multidisciplinary approach. Oral surgeons are another, or maxillofacial surgeons could be also important for us. So basically, and of course dentists, these are some of the professionals that should know about myofunctional disorders and can do something by working together to manage them or resolve them.
Well, I think anybody that sees people is probably fair game. I know from taking my breathing classes with the Buteyko breathing expert Patrick McGowan that even a psychologist or a psychiatrist may be part of this multidisciplinary team, as breathing properly can influence anxiety and pressures and all the things that come along with anxiety and stress.
Sure. Absolutely.
And so, you know, even that, and I was at the beauty parlor the other day and I thought, you know, these women listen to people chatter all day long about their aches and pains. And if they knew how to just ask a question or two and refer them to the right kind of a person, even they could be part of this whole thing. Because they do study the structures of the head and the face before they start their hair cutting class.
Right, and you brought up a very good point, which is Buteyko breathing practitioners or breathing re-educators. They're very, very important because they prepare the field for myofunctional therapists to optimize or normalize the functions again. But you need to work with nasal breathing first, and that's very important. I see more and more practitioners to get involved. Even in some cases, even massage therapists or physical therapists or occupational therapists, the point is every professional within his or her own scope of practice can apply principles of myofunctional therapy so that the physical therapist might be able to address the neck position or the shoulder position, which are very important in rest position, but also in chewing and swallowing. Or if it's an occupational therapist, they might be able to work on decreased sensitization of the mouth or increase that. So every professional has a way of including principles of myofunctional therapy, and they should.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. We all see people all the time. And there are some real obvious things that could stimulate a conversation or a referral to an OMT person that could help facilitate or branch out into other areas. So, for instance, if we're talking about an occupational therapist making a referral to a OMT, to an OMT, that OMT may, in fact, refer that person to a dentist or to an oral surgeon. So it's a back and forth. This isn't like the center hub of the universe here. This is a true multidisciplinary issue that needs, you know, input from all kinds of people, in grown people. I think dental hygienists and pediatricians would benefit from having at least a remedial level of training in this so that they can detect these problems early on, so that we don't need surgery later or we don't need a high level of therapy after.
Absolutely. And to build on this, I do believe that a missing link, in a sense, is more emphasis on prevention. Looking at people very early on, possibly on the first day of life, to see if they have any anatomical restriction, like a tongue tie, that could set them on the wrong path in terms of growth and development. And so if you look at the patient point of view of prevention, like I'm sure dental hygienists are very good at that, you can actually nudge the patient into good behaviors, or in a sense fix certain small aspects right away, and really promote lifelong health,
right,
as opposed to jumping in 20 years later and trying to fix a problem that now it's a multi-structured and multi-function. Like if you have an allergy and so the patient doesn't breathe the nose, then the palate might get restricted, then you have to expand the palate, then you have malocclusion, then you have thrust, you have a typical swallowing, difficulty in chewing, and blah blah, sleep disorders, and blah blah blah.
So it just keeps going down and down.
Right, but we don't think in those terms. We, you know, we have a concept of healthcare almost like a sick care. Show me the disease, I'll fix it, but very little is mentioned in terms of prevention. What can we do on day one, on day two, during the weaning period? How can we help kids grow healthy and to their full potential?
Excellent. Alicia, we're out of time for this segment of the special on the World Day of OM Sciences, and I appreciate you taking the time out to do this interview and the expanded interview, which the link is on this page here. So I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Shirley.
That was Alicia Pasquet, who is the president of the Academy of Applied Myofunctional Sciences, talking with us about the scope that myofunctional science has on medicine and health in general. Next, we're going to be talking with Dr. DeWald and her new way of looking at her practice. And before that, I'd like to just share with you a little bit of a off the record conversation I had with Joy Moeller, and then we'll go right into our conversation with Dr. DeWald.
Gimeno did a thing on death and infants, and they all had the common factor with them was high neural palate with sudden infant death. They all had their children that died in their sleep in the first 5 years, but they had common thread of high neural palate.
Crazy. You know, where's the newspapers about that? Why isn't that on every news channel for a week?
I know.
So next is Dr. Denise DeWald, is a primary care physician at a federally qualified health center on the south side of Chicago. She is dual board certified in pediatrics and internal medicine, and she has completed a combined residency in internal medicine and pediatrics at the University of Illinois at Chicago. She is using her newly found skills in myofunctional therapy to observe and understand her patients' problems in a new way, in a distinct way from the traditional medical training. The oral airway has been neglected by the medical profession because of the artificial chasm between medicine and dentistry. And physicians don't learn about the mouth, as she's finding too, and that dentists don't learn about the airway. And that is really harming our patients. Welcome, Dr. DeWald.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. So let's talk a little bit about how your practice has changed now that you have a different respect for the airway. Are you doing anything different? Are you interviewing your patients differently? How does that look?
Yeah, well, I really focus a lot on how people are breathing. So especially as a pediatrician, you know, we have all of our vaccination schedules and all that. And so, like, before I learned all this stuff, pretty much the most important thing, make sure the kids' vaccinations are up to date. And then we have, like, our anticipatory guidance. But now I feel that my number one job as a pediatrician is to spot when a child's airway is not developing properly and try to intervene effectively to restore normal function to that child's airway, so that it develops and they have a greater chance of long-term health throughout their life because their oral airways develop normally.
And how do you do that? Do you just observe them, or how does that look for you? How is that different from just saying, oh, you look like your vaccines aren't up to date. You better get on that.
So the biggest thing is a child's nose breathing or mouth breathing. So when they come into my clinic, and I see their mouth closed, and they're breathing through their nose. First, I'm like, oh, good. We're good there. Mm-hmm. And then the next thing I ask mom is, like, does so-and-so sleep with their mouth open? Do they snore? And if they're sleeping with their mouth open, I know there's already a problem developing. If they snore, now we're already having problems with an airway that's being compromised during sleep. Mm-hmm. Because the snoring is actually a very very concrete sign that the airway is narrowing during sleep. And that narrowing of the airway then can cause microarousals or, you know, actually make children wake up. So they're not sleeping as well. And they're not getting the type of sleep that they need to do their best in school and to be on their best behavior at all time. And you can actually measure that. There have been studies that show that snoring, just plain old snoring in children, affects their ability to do work in school.
That's kind of crazy because a lot of kids snore. Are you finding that there's a lot of kids snoring?
Oh, yeah. In my population, it's about 80% of my pediatric patients snore.
And they're all 300-pound little four-year-olds?
No, they're not.
No, really?
Even like thin kids are snoring. So a lot of the reasons that the kids snore, one, you know, if they have a little bit of nasal obstruction, like if their adenoids are big, their tonsils are big, or if they just are habitual mouth breathers, that happens as well. And so what often happens, you know, if your tongue isn't stuck on the roof of your mouth and your mouth is hanging open, your tongue is unrestrained. And so your tongue and your jaw can fall into your airway at night. And then you snore, and you wake yourself up. You have to move around to so that your airway is open.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually find snoring not a very good screening question for sleep disordered breathing. I know it's like one of the gold standard questions, but just open mouth breathing and disturbed sleep. If the child's moving around a lot at night, that means that child isn't sleeping well.
Yeah, and well, because their airway is bad. I don't know that parents would recognize that the strumpled bed and that the pillow on the floor in the morning and stuff would be right. A symptom of an airway restriction.
Right, and because it's also like they're normal too.
Yeah.
And, like, this is very common. Like when I mentioned this to my mom about, oh, my daughter's like breathing with her mouth open and that's a problem, she's like, all kids breathe with their mouth open because that's how my brother and I do.
Yeah, isn't it crazy? It's like a new normal.
It is.
It's so pervasive that people think it's not odd at all anymore.
No. And so I have a little very unorthodox method of treating the kids who are like 4 or 5 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I give out mouth tape to my patients.
Really?
And it's just like, yes, to help them keep their mouth shut at night. And they actually sleep better. And there was actually a study in Taiwan done with like some special, they called it like a porous oral patch, but it's really just a piece of tape to keep your mouth shut.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually decreases snoring, and it can decrease the AHI, the apnea hypopnea index, in mild sleep apnea. And I use mouth tape, and it's made a big difference for me and in my patients that I've given it to, and they come back, and they're saying, you know what, that stuff really works.
Wow, that's pretty awesome. So even a little four-year-old, you have them try the tape.
Yep, and they like it.
Yeah.
It's kind of unusual, but all it is getting the tongue on the roof of the mouth and trying to restrain it there.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm also working to try to bring mouth exercises, sort of this myofunctional therapy to my patients. You know, they're in no situation where they'd be able to go weekly to see a myofunctional therapist.
Mm-hmm.
It's not covered by Medicaid. They don't have the time. They don't have the resources. So I'm trying to bring them exercises and like videos that they can watch online and do it mm-hmm. at home on their own. So I'm working with Janet Bennett, who's a speech pathologist. She has this I Just Want to Sleep program. And so this is just in its infancy. We're just starting this project, and we're hoping to be able to do some research to show that we're doing it, you know, some benefit for these kids.
Mm-hmm.
But these are the things that I'm trying to do, because getting them, and I refer them to the ear, nose, and throat doctors, but most of them actually don't go, unfortunately.
Well, it's hard. I know that, who was I talking to one day? It's totally agreed with me. being poor takes a lot of time. Everything you have to do takes twice as long because your car doesn't work. You have to take the bus. Your computer is too old. It's just everything. It takes forever, and having a separate appointment for a different doctor, and you might have to take a whole day off of work instead of just an hour like anybody else.
Exactly. So. It's a real struggle. And, you know, I see adults too, and sleep disordered breathing is rampant in my adult population as well. And it's like a joke, hardly anyone gets like I say, about 30 to 50% of my adult patients get referred to sleep studies at some point.
Wow.
Because, you know, especially the ones who are a little bit older, overweight, you know, and it's just rampant. It's really common.
So
in my population.
When kids are mouth breathing, we know that they'll turn into teenagers with long kind of faces. And that's called, that has a special name.
It's called the adenoid facies.
Facies. And then, yes. So, but that has nothing to do with the adenoids.
Well, it comes from nasal obstruction. So if kids have allergies and they're forced to breathe through their mouth, then, you know, because their adenoids are enlarged, then they have this, it's a developmental sequence that occurs when this process starts during early childhood. And it's recognized as causing these changes. And actually, they're like Dr. Mike Mew in his video, Modern Melting Faces, showed that there's been animal research showing if they took infant monkeys, and like put a little obstructing device in their nostrils and showed that they developed the long faces and the narrow jaws and the crowded teeth that are typical of what happens to children who develop the adenoid facies. But they also were able to show that if they removed the nasal obstruction early enough during the infant monkey's development, that their face could revert to normal and their airway could revert to normal. And so that's what I'm trying to do with my children, my pediatric patients. If I can fix them early enough, I can get them to have a normal airway and a normal face. And that, to me, as a pediatrician, I feel like I've made a tremendous, you know, difference in this kid's life.
I would agree. I think that you would probably have done more for that child than giving them an extra vaccine or whatever. That's
absolutely
a topic for another day. Thank you so much. We are out of time for this shortened version here on the 2-hour special of CrossLink Radio and the World Day of Oral Facial Myofunctional Therapy Science. And Dr. DeWald, I really appreciate your time with us today, and I wish you the best and continue on with forging ahead. This is awesome.
Thank you, and thank you so much for doing this, because the more of us that get involved in this, the better off our whole country, the world will be.
That's why I'm doing it. It's going to prompt questions, and people will start to look for answers and have more and more discussions. So I appreciate you coming along for the ride a little bit.
This program is sponsored by Primal Air, orofacial myofunctional therapy and breathing retraining. Located in the heart of Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, Primal Air is dedicated to integrating oral and systemic health. By learning specialized techniques, you can achieve the full genetic potential of your personal airway. Tongue-tied? Hate your CPAP? Don't want to look tired? Call or email to schedule an in-person or virtual appointment. 608-213-5865 or primalairomt@gmail.com.
All right, now we have Marge Ferran, a practicing dental hygienist of over 30 years who began her journey in orofacial myofunctional therapy in 2010. She has taken number of courses on oral facial myofunctional therapy as well as breathing re-education courses. She lives in Montana, and she is the only certified oral facial myofunctional therapist, and she is certified by the IAOM. And we're going to talk a little bit to Marge about infant facial development and breathing and allergies and how that relates to facial development, I guess is probably the easiest way to say that.
Well, basically, you know, infants are born to be obligate nasal breathers if all their structures are correct. And actually, babies prefer to nasal breathe. And so this all starts out when we start to breastfeed, hopefully, because that's the best way to get the best start for orofacial growth and development. but the child will learn how to suck, breathe, and swallow, which I'm sure you're going to cover in some other episodes. And if all this is in place, then this helps to drive the shape and growth of the mouth. And if children, for some reason, have some difficulties, maybe they start to develop some allergies. Maybe they start to get some large tonsils that are going on, too. And then they'll start to breathe through their mouth more. And what will happen is the mouth will stay open, and we don't get the driving force to get the jaws to move forward away from the back of the mouth. And you'll maybe, as a child gets a little bit older, not necessarily an infant, we sometimes don't see all that, but their face is going to start to look maybe more long,
mm-hmm.
and they're going to get a long face appearance.
But that doesn't happen. That doesn't happen, you know, right away. They don't start with a long, skinny face, do they?
No. You're not going to see that real early. I mean, you're going to mostly see the child probably have an open mouth posture, and probably when they get to be four and five, that's when you're going to start to see that longer face starting to develop. Right. And you know, you may see some crowding of the teeth initially too. You like to have lots of spaces in between those teeth.
Let's go back to this allergy for a second, because in an infant, they're not, I don't know, the whole allergy conversation has really gotten muddied by the idea that an allergy means that you break out in hives or you're itchy or something like that. But it doesn't have to be that obvious. You can be allergic to things that have that are totally oblivious to anybody looking on the surface. It takes a little bit of discovery. For instance,
right.
I'm allergic to dairy and to eggs. Who knew that? They're staples in my diet, but I have a pretty high inflammatory response due to that reaction. And maybe there's a better term than allergy, but how do you know that an infant, what are we supposed to do, a skin test? What are we supposed to do for an infant? What are you looking for?
Well, I would say, you know, probably the most obvious sign, if it's a really full-blown allergy, you're going to see probably some residue in the nose, and that's going to start to get the nose plugged. And you might think that they have a cold, but it keeps on going,
mm-hmm.
and they don't have any signs of sneezing. They may have signs of sneezing, but they're not coughing like with a typical cold. And so you clear the nose, and all of a sudden it's starting to get blocked up again,
mm-hmm.
and you just don't seem to ever get to the end. Then you might need to seek help from another professional to see what's going on there. Sometimes children won't have any signs of any allergies, and it may not be caught till they're much older.
Do babies have tonsils that could be visible? I don't know that I've ever looked in any of my kids' mouth to see if they had tonsils.
Yeah. I am not really sure about that. I know, you know, you can see them when they get to be about three, for sure.
Yeah, right.
You know, and then that's going to fight for room for the tongue. And if they're breathing through their mouth, the tonsils are going to be the filtration system. And that's because you need to stop those allergens and those pollutants from getting into the body. So those tonsils are going to get larger.
Mm-hmm.
And again, with the nose, you know, you've got that built-in filtration system to work. But if they've got the allergies, then you're just going to be fighting a vicious cycle.
Right.
Until you get that addressed by a professional.
So if they do have airway resistance, let's call it that way, because it doesn't have to be a full-blown apneic event. It could just be that there's resistance due to enlarged tonsils or adenoids or some kind of a structural problem with the septum. And just, you know, there's a million reasons. But what are you looking for as a myofunctional therapist? Not in an infant, but in your patients?
Right. Yeah, so I would see the children probably about age 4 or 5, and I do a lot of observation. My initial evaluation takes quite long, but I would observe them, and there's certain techniques that we can look at. We can look at if their nostrils move with breathing. We have them sit there for, you know, X number of seconds and see if they have to open their mouth. Then you can it's kind of a simplistic way to look at that and see if they're mouth breathing, but you can usually get a pretty good idea, especially if you're, you know, just chatting with mom and just kind of observing what they're doing. And then also just looking back in the throat and screening and seeing if their tonsils are very large. If that happens, then you're going to probably have to refer them to a specialist and get evaluated, because you want to make sure that they're breathing through their nose, 100% of the day, and that includes nighttime. And the specialists, the ENTs, are the ones that are going to be able to look at that and decide how much of an airway that they have and if there's any issues at nighttime when they're sleeping, that type of thing. So
this is the second time I've wanted to bring up chiropractic, so I'm going to ask if you're also working with a chiropractor.
I don't have a chiropractor, but I do have somebody who practices craniosacral therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And so it could be that something happened during the birth process, that maybe there's some muscles that are pulling incorrectly and they need to have those released so that, maybe the child can stand up straighter, have the head straight,
mm-hmm.
and then open up those muscles to allow that airway to be more open. And then there could be an issue of being tongue-tied also, which can affect, airway issues and where the tongue is placed in the mouth when you're not eating or talking. And so those children not only need to have something done with that tissue underneath the tongue that's too tight, that will inhibit the tongue from being the roof of the mouth, but a lot of other associated muscles are affected too. And so you may need to see someone who does cranial sacral or a specialist who does chiropractic, who specializes in the muscles of the mouth and face in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes a lot of different specialists to address all these issues,
including
the myofunctional therapist who works with the muscles, and then, trying to figure out what's going on, where the detective, and then trying to help the patient to get directed to where they need to go to get all these different issues addressed.
Yeah, it's amazing how much the orofacial myofunctional therapy practice interacts with so many different other disciplines. I was working with somebody a couple of months ago, and they were talking about their biggest referral source was an endocrinologist that was in the area. So who would have thought, right? Who would have thought?
No.
So, all right. So now we have this nasal breathing that's so important. We need the tongue up at the top of the into the palate to act as a palatal expander, if you will, in an infant. If there's a tongue tie, the tongue can't reach up to the palate, and that contributes to a bunch of things. But now the kid is three, and now is the time to teach them how to blow their nose so that they maintain their airway on their own a little bit more.
Correct, yeah. And if they have any tonsil issues, hopefully the pediatrician's taking a look at that, then they're going to have to seek help from other professionals just to, maybe they'll be able to grow out of them too. But again, that may be where the myofunctional therapist comes in, is just teaching them how to breathe through their nose. And then hopefully Mother Nature can take care of those tonsils and shrink them down the way they should be as they grow older.
Right. The nose blowing is kind of a little bit of a trick. As we discussed at length in the extended interview, and teaching that and teaching it correctly should be part of every new mom's kit. It should be part of what you learn as a mother to teach your children, because it's not tricky, but there's a right way and there's a not right way. You can't just kind of wipe the nose and call it a day. You have to kind of teach the kid how to put their tongue and how to close the one nostril and blow and stuff like that. So I think that's not something that gets discussed very often at all.
No, because the child, sometimes they're going to end up keeping their mouth open. So you have to, if you get your tongue up on the roof of the mouth, and the lips are going to probably tend to close, correct, and then you're going to be able to get that air to come through the nose, which takes a little bit of effort from these little people to figure out how to do that.
You have to know what you're looking for, and that's really kind of crazy that nobody ever thinks that the kid's mouth is hanging open. Close your mouth. Are you catching flies? You hear that, those kind of comments a lot. But it could be that they just don't know how to get their nose clean so that they can get air through.
Yeah, and that's why myofunctional therapists are so good about this, because we look at a lot of different aspects, and so, we can help the parents to teach the child how to do that. you know, and then continue on to with different techniques to get them to keep their lips closed and get that nose working correctly. But the more you can breathe through the nose, the clearer it's going to stay.
Marge, how can people get in touch with you and your practice in Montana?
Again, I'm the only hygienist in Montana who is performing myofunctional therapy, and my business name is Montana Myofunctional Therapy. I have a website, and that's montanamyofunctionaltherapy.com. I also have a Facebook page where I address a lot of issues about airway, and the name of my Facebook page is Montana Myofunctional Therapy. And on both of those places, I also have my phone number or an email link if you need to get a hold of me.
Thank you so much. And for people that want to know a little bit more, the extended version of this interview can be found on my website, crosslinkradio.com, and also on blogtalkradio.com. So have a great rest of the day. Thank you, Marge.
Thank you.